This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to Robin Gaby Fisher. She's the co-author of a book called The Woman Who Wasn't There, The True Story of an Incredible Deception. And Robin is a journalist, and she co-authored this book with Angelo Guglielmo, who is a filmmaker who actually was involved in the story. Now, I want to let you tell the story, but just as the sort of lead-in, this is a book about a woman who was portrayed herself as a survivor of 9/11, and not only a survivor, but whose husband had been killed in the first crash while she was in the second crash, and was able to escape. It's an amazing story. And of course, you know, unlike some mysteries, you give it away at the beginning because you say the true story of an incredible deception. So, you know, unlike fiction and novels where I don't want to give away the ending, in this case, I think we can talk about the whole story. Anyway, thank you for doing this, Robin. And maybe you could talk a little bit about, you know, you could do the lead in and talk about the general story and how you got involved and, you know, all that stuff.
Sure. Absolutely, and thank you, David. Thank you so much for having me on. I was contacted by my agent, who in New York, and he called and he said, you know, I have this story that I think is fascinating. I have a filmmaker who came to me, and he has footage that he wants to make into a documentary, but the agent said, I think there's a book here. I'd like for you to meet him and see what you think. And so I went into New York City, and I met with my agent, David Patterson of Foundry Media, and with Angelo. And he started telling me this story of this woman who, it happened, had been his very, very good friend. And the more he talked, you know, I went into it thinking, I really don't want to do a 9/11 book. I covered 9/11 as a journalist. I was right in there. It was horror. And I thought, I'm not sure people want to read about 9/11. But it quickly became very clear that this was a story with 9/11 as the backdrop, but it was a story of the most amazing, incredible scam. And it was also the story of survivors, which I had never thought that much about, and until I started delving into this subject and researching this subject. But at any rate, it still took me weeks to decide to actually agree to do the book. Of course, now I'm so glad I did.
Well, it is an amazing story, and of course, I felt like you had to make this conscious decision at the beginning to tell the story as if we didn't know the end. In other words, you started the book out saying, you know, talking about this woman whose name was Tanya Head, who and her incredible story. So you told her story. You know, you're sort of knowing all the time that she's going to, you know, as a reader, I know all the time at the end something is going to be, this deception, which went on for years, is going to be revealed. So, you know, just in terms of the structure of the book, I understand why you did that, and it makes a lot of sense to keep a narrative drive moving forward. So you read about this woman, and her story is incredible, that she was I think, as I remember this, that she, when the first building hit, she heard the noise and went, and contrary to what the people in the second tower were saying, you know, stay in your desk, she panicked and she tried to get out of the building, ending up on the 78th floor, where the express elevators to get to the bottom were staged,
right.
And that's
yeah.
when the second plane hit. So, you know, she has this amazing description of, you know, carnage essentially, and fire, and a guy who helped her, and you know, as the story goes on, mm-hmm. she becomes this powerful figure,
right.
In the survivor movement, and that was something I, as you said, I was I had not really, fo you know, probably like most of us, had not focused on the survivors who we'd focused on, and especially if you live in the New York City area, typically you would focus on people who lost loved ones, in
That's
you know,
right.
in family members usually, you know, in our, you know, my town, I know people, my next door neighbors, and you know, everybody around here just about. I knew, you know, people who were in some way connected through that, but you wouldn't necessarily. We didn't hear about survivors, and what happens in the book is that you learn that they were suffering terribly from what amounts
Terribly.
to, post-traumatic stress syndrome, and
Yes.
that they this woman Tanya Head and a number of other people started a network of survivors, and then it merged with another organization. And Angelo, your co-author, who was v very deeply involved in this because he was a member of that network, was close to Tanya, so he was one of the characters in the book, as well as being, a teller of the story.
Correct.
So, so you go through all of this, and then, you find out that she was a fraud. And so, and of course, I think this is really fascinating in many ways. You wonder, as a reader, how could all of those people who knew her kind of willfully not check when, for instance, she never produced the parents-in-law, or,
Right.
and no one ever really checked to see or discovered that she wasn't really married to the guy that she said she was
Right.
married to, who was killed in the crash, and he was a real person who was killed. So her
Yes.
story was brilliantly put together,
Yes, it
and
was.
but it's really hard to fool, as they say, you can't fool all of the people all of the time. So eventually she was uncovered. I think well, it was by the essentially by a New York Times
It
journalist.
was. The New York Times that didn't start out to uncover anything, but simply wanted to do what so many newspapers had already done, and that was a profile of this incredible woman, the survivor. And it was only after they began trying to get interviews with her, and she kept canceling, that David Dunlap, the Times reporter, started just doing some just the same thing we all do as journalists, just regular background checks, starting to check all of the simple things that she had talked about, where she had gone to college, her marriage ceremony, working at Merrill Lynch. And he found as he was just doing these normal background checks in anticipation of eventually getting the interview, that the most simple things weren't adding up, that Merrill Lynch said, "We don't have anyone employed by that name." And she said she went to Harvard, and Harvard said, "We don't have anyone by that name who graduated from Harvard." Same with her graduate school that she said she went to, Stanford. So then, of course, they got very, very suspicious, and they started checking out all parts of her story, and they realized, wow, that we've got more here than a sixth anniversary profile.
Well, let me ask you, this is sort of what differentiates her from the many cases of fraud that, that you could say that goes from con men to just somebody faking their resume who use it for personal gain, to get a job, or to, the football coach who says, I was a Rhodes Scholar, to embellish the resume, to help get a job or a raise, or maybe they even tell a story about owning a business so they can get you to do something with them. The fake investment, all those different things that con artists do are done
Yes.
for personal financial gain almost always. But in this
That's right.
case, there was no personal financial gain. In fact, it was the other way around. She was making donations. She didn't have the job that she said she had. She really
Right.
was, I think, from a fairly well-to-do family, which in Spain, so she had money, but she was giving money to these organizations, out of her own pocket. That all of the fakery was not about personal financial gain, it was about emotional issues,
That's
or
to
identity.
me, yes, to me, that was one of the most fascinating aspects of this story. I thought the fact that she didn't take any money, that money was never her motivation, that in fact she contributed quite a bit of money to the network. She hosted all kinds of fundraisers. She was from a very, very wealthy family in Barcelona. The fact that it wasn't for money, I thought, made the whole story even more intriguing. And as it turned out, you know, I mean, really, she did it because she could never get enough attention. Her appetite for attention was insatiable. And so, you know, she was a young girl. She had a vivid imagination. And people from her childhood said she used to make things up, little things that maybe other kids make up occasionally. But her lies got bigger and bigger. And then eventually, it was, you know, her lies were painted on 9/11. I just think that makes the story so much more interesting, that financial gain was not her motivation, but the attention and the celebrity, really.
Well, I agree. And but of course, then there is the fact that it was not harmless as well, mm-hmm. because of all the people that she involved. And who's not only were hurt along, I mean, there are two levels of hurt, I think. One of the things you outlined in the story was that she actually kind of subtly manipulated the situation at various times to get rid of people who might threaten her in some way. Because not only was mm-hmm. she interested in attention, but she really wanted to be in control. And partially you figure that the control issues have to do with needing to maintain this fake identity. But so she would get people out of the organization who offended her in some way. And that was terrible in some ways, that she was manipulating so many people. So that there were levels of victimization going on, not to mention the people who ended up loving her and who cared for her and spent time taking care of her because she appeared to be emotionally fragile. And, you know, she was a victim on several levels. And people who were around her spent an amazing amount of emotional capital on her, and then find out afterwards or at this certain point that they'd been taken emotionally. That must be devastating, because the people that she was fooling were also truly survivors who were in pain.
They were in terrible pain. They felt as if they had been victimized all over again. One of the things she stole from them, which is it's the saddest thing, I think, is so many of the survivors who were the closest to her gave up their own therapy, gave up their own time to heal, to devote themselves to her, because she was in more pain than all of them, because she had suffered more than all of them. And so as a result, I mean, there were people, they put her before their own healing. And so their healing, they were suffering, but taking care of her. At the same time, she completely took advantage of some of the most vulnerable survivors, the ones who had seen horrible things, the ones who were going through terrible trauma. And, you know, she shamelessly used them, and they willingly gave her their undivided attention and love.
Well, there must be. I mean, you know, on one level, I'm sure that there's a great deal of anger toward her. And on another level, you have to assume that a person who could do this is pathologically, sort of sociopath in a way, that the narcissism is really the right word, and it's the perfect word to describe her, that you would, you know, take from people in order to fill in this emotional hole that she obviously has, so that you could say that someone who is capable of such a massive emotional fraud is really massively damaged herself. Almost, you know, you might even, I mean, I'm not a psychiatrist, so I would never have any right to say this, but it feels like she's, you know, really far gone as a human being.
And to this day, she contends that everything she said was true. She has absolutely no remorse. She blames the survivors for speaking to the New York Times about her, No one has ever gotten an apology. In fact, she continued her scam when she sent out an email after it all happened claiming that Tanya Head had committed suicide. So narcissist is the word. I believe she's an absolute narcissist with no conscience.
No, it's an amazing. It's just hard to conceptualize, you know, that this sort of, you know, when you think about what she did, there are two things that I kind of came up with to think about. Was one was I found it difficult to understand how, in, you know, this incredibly connected world that we live in, that where people are checking, they have access to so much information about everybody and everything, that you know, she was able to get away with it for so long. But the other part that really struck me was the degree of her, you know, the degree of her craziness to be able to want to do this in a way.
Yes, and I mean, think about it. She actually took on Mayor Giuliani and Mayor Bloomberg and Governor Pataki, told them her story while giving them the inaugural tour of Ground Zero as it was being rebuilt, the Tribute Center. And she had no shame. She stood there and told them everything she told the other survivors. She was chosen. She was the chosen survivor to give these top dignitaries this tour and told them the same story. I mean, attention. Again, it was attention. It was narcissism. It was all about her.
Well, you also, you remember, you know, think about the ability to be out on a limb like that all by yourself. I mean, that's pretty scary, too, that, you know, if you've ever anybody who's ever done public speaking feels nervous in the first place, because, and that's even when you're trying, you know, you're being authentically yourself and telling your story, but telling a made up story in public consistently in front of, you know, as you said, and now in her case, many cases, in many times, she was in front of famous people. She was highly public. It's just remarkable. I mean, there's a certain, you know, beauty to it in a certain horrible way that she was able to be that brilliant.
She is, without a doubt, which also makes it fascinating, she's absolutely brilliant. I mean, people in, she went to ASADE, college in Barcelona, and people who went to school with her said, you know, she was absolutely brilliant. Unfortunately, she used her intellect and her great brain to deceive. But yeah, she's very, very smart. But the thing is, you know, they always say to be a good liar, you have to keep your story straight. And she actually tripped up quite a few times, but nobody ever called her on it. So she kept getting away.
Well, so talk a little bit about this, you know, the way she was able to get away with it, because I thought that was pretty interesting, too, that, you know, there was, I guess, the feeling among a lot of the people that she worked with that they wouldn't dare, kind of emotionally, they would say it to themselves, you know, they wouldn't want to cause her any more pain by questioning her on any element of her story. I mean, did you talk, when you talked to the people around her, did you press them on that, or did you feel that would be, you know, actually for you, that might have been a difficulty, you know, because that must be a very difficult place for a lot of those people to look back and say, I had a feeling, but I didn't say anything.
That's right. And I did, when I did many, many, many interviews with all of the survivors, and it kept coming back to that. They're so embarrassed that they believed her. And there were moments that, when they think back now in retrospect, there were moments when a couple of them had tiny little doubts, or she'd say something that was different than the things she had said before. For instance, she would call Dave her fiancé in one conversation and her husband in another, and then make up this ludicrous story about how she wasn't quite married but almost married, and so they would let it go. But they all told me the same thing, that every time they might have even a slight doubt about her story, they would and question it, they would then turn it on themselves and think, what a terrible person I am for questioning this poor, poor woman who's gone through so much. And as they all said, who would ever think that someone would make up a story like this? I mean, it's beyond comprehension. Who would ever think that? And so they would let these things go. I mean, we've all done things like that, you know?
Well, have you looked at any of the... I mean, because I think that I've heard about other people pretending to be 9/11 firefighters. I think there was one that was uncovered fairly recently. I think, was it in Florida? Yeah, I guess it was in... He was pretending to be a New York firefighter, retired New York firefighter, lived in Florida, and... It didn't take long for people, you know, they kind of, the fire department people in Florida checked with some of their colleagues in New York and figured it out. But
that's right.
It's not unknown. I mean, there are other cases of people pretending to be victims. But it must, it's very hard. It's got to be really difficult to be authentic and get away with it for as long as she did in such a public way as she did. Because,
for
you know,
5 years.
Yeah, and if, I mean, it's different. Like, if you're in Florida, you're not in New York. You know, people there might not know as much about the events. But if you're in New York, you're going to run across people who were there. And that was another sort of surprising thing is, you know, here she is in New York, and none of the people that were in the building who she might have run or who might have run across her ever came forward and said, you know, I was there and I don't remember you. I mean, and you can see why, because it was so horrible and, you know, just
chaotic,
terrible day. You know, you might not remember anything. But you did mention this. There was also the, oh, this was also just terrible. The man who on the 78th floor had the red bandana around his mouth and who was and pretty famously had saved a number of people by pointing them to the door where they could get down the stairs, and had himself perished. And she then befriended his family.
His family, Wells Crowther.
Right.
That is, talk about audacity. I mean, what she did was she studied 9/11. I mean, she was a 9/11 scholar, really. And she, her story was populated with all real people. All of those real people happened to have died in the attack, but with the Crowthers, it was someone said to them, I think I just heard someone who your son saved, and it was because Tanya was giving a tour of Ground Zero to tourists, and during that told her own story and mentioned that this young man with a red bandana saved her life. Well, everybody knew at that point that there was a young man with a red bandana named Wells Crowther who had died in the towers but had saved quite a few people that day, and which led to his own death because he didn't get out in time. And then when Wells Crowther's mother asked to meet her, she went to dinner with them at the Princeton Club and told her story. And then they invited her to speak at his memorial service, and they became very close friends. Again, absolutely no remorse, no conscience.
Did you talk to them after, while you were writing the book? You would sort of feel maybe ambivalent about talking to people who had been so emotionally abused by this person, but I'm kind of curious if you were able to do it.
Yeah, well, the Crowthers are such kind, forgiving people. And really, all they want is for... All they were concerned about with this book is that their son's legacy and that their son's story wasn't sullied. And of course it isn't, because he was truly a hero. So they spoke for the film and for the book. I think just trusting that we were going to portray it exactly as it was. I mean, Wells didn't do anything wrong, you know.
He's another victim of her storytelling.
Absolutely. His family and he absolutely true. As were the family of the man she said she was married to. Now, if you'll notice, his last name was redacted in the book.
Yes, I did see that.
Because out of respect for his family, because his family had a very hard time having her name associated with their son. We couldn't tell the story, of course, without him, so we decided and talked to them and agreed that we would redact his name but keep the story in there. So he's a real person, but his family is truly devastated by what she's done.
Now, you mentioned a film, and I do want to talk about that a little bit. Angelo, your writing partner and actually the person who was part of the story, also this irony, he's a documentary filmmaker and a survivor, and one of the things that they did with Tanya was, I think she, and she is involved with this, he was making a documentary film about the survivors, and he filmed many hours of her talking.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right.
And so you had all of that as resource. You know, you've got her kind of, I mean, it is sort of funny because it's not, she gets hoisted by her own petard instead of, you know, there isn't, it's not hearsay. It's right there on film.
It's right there on film. I mean, I watched so many hours of video with her. What happened was Angelo, after 9/11, he wasn't actually a 9/11 victim, but the day after, as a New York City resident, he went to Ground Zero to volunteer to help. And he made a lot of friends down there. He made a film called The Heart of Steel, which was about the volunteer effort. And so he sort of became known in the 9/11 community. When she showed up, they met through this whole network. And she asked him, because she had seen his first film, The Heart of Steel, if he would consider making a second documentary about 9/11, this one about the survivors. He didn't really want to do that in the beginning, but she was so persistent, and he became so close to her, such good friends with her, that he finally agreed to do it, focusing on a core group of survivors, but specifically on her, because her story, as we say, was the most fantastic of all. And so she sat down with him, although it took a lot of work to get her to sit down. She used to try to, cancel interviews, and she was a little nervous about it, but she eventually came through. And there are hours of her talking on tape, telling her survivor story. So he was filming her and was, again, one of her victims as well, because, you know, he became one of her best friends. He believed she was who she said she was. And then it turned out that she was a fake, and he had all this tape of her telling her story. It's really amazing.
Oh, that is incredible. So now he has made a film now that tell me what's the film called, and when is it showing?
Okay, his film is called The Woman Who Wasn't There, and it is being produced by Meredith Sierra Productions. And it's being shown on Investigation Discovery later this month, April 16th. And I've seen it, and it's terrific. I like the book better because the book is able to go in more detail, and because I love the book. But it's fascinating. It's really, really fascinating.
Well, it is, that I think would be worth seeing, even, as a, maybe just as complimentary to the book.
It is.
Yeah, I think the book, some people like books better than film, and other people like both, and it's, but I think it would be really interesting to see, having read the book now, I think it actually would be really interesting to see the people involved, which you would be able to do, and then to see her talking about herself, because, you can't help but be fascinated by someone who is that brilliant of a fake. And this sort of, I think as human beings, the extreme human behavior is really interesting, because we get to see what the full range of humanity can be. And it doesn't mean I like the idea of people who are, who cause harm to others by being so extreme. I'm not, I don't think it's a kind of vicarious thrill, but it is it is important to know what people are capable of. That this, it's not really that we have to like it, but we just know that people are this capable of being so different and so extreme in their behaviors.
That's right.
She's a, an amazing case. And of course, what's really weird about it is that she's walking around, as you mentioned, I think in the book, that Angelo saw her on the
That was a
street, right?
comedy. That was almost a comedy because I was at school. I teach journalism at Rutgers, and I was in my office, and Angelo called me, and he was almost hysterical. Robin, Robin, he was out of breath. I see her. I see her. I said, "What are you talking about?" Now, by now, I'm almost finished with the book, and he says, "It's Tanya. What do I do? What do I do?" And I said, "We had not been able to find her." So I said, "Angelo, follow her." And he was so upset and so frazzled. And I said, "If you lose her, I am going to kill you. Follow her." I jumped in my car, drove toward New York to meet him, and got stuck in the Lincoln Tunnel in traffic. And he's calling me, and I'm in the tunnel telling him, he's telling me what he's seeing, and I'm telling him what to continue to do. And finally, he followed her to this boutique hotel that she was staying in with her mother, and watched her for a couple of hours. And by then, I got there. She ended up coming out 2 hours later of the hotel, and she went to a bus stop. She was dressed beautifully in a black dress. She had lost quite a bit of weight. She looked quite attractive. And both of us, I mean, he ended up confronting her, and she ended up chasing him down the street while I was trying to inside trying to talk to her mother. She chased him down the street, and then she called the police on us. We had the district attorney call us and say she was complaining that we were harassing her. But I found myself thinking, well, where is she going and who is she now? You know, I wish I could have jumped on that bus anonymously and just seen where she was going, because I'm certain she's no longer Tanya Head, but she's someone else and she's scamming other people. And I'm hoping really and truly that the book saves some other people from what the survivors have been through because of her.
Well, that's an interesting thought that she would be a serial, whatever it is, she can't stop doing it. It's like being, that's her persona now, to achieve what she needs emotionally. So you're, yeah, that's sort of it. I hadn't actually thought about that before, that she would continue, that in, not having been exposed, that it would not embarrass her in any way or stop her from doing it. I mean, she really would just keep on going unless somebody gets her some kind of therapy.
That's exactly right. Well, her therapist, the man she was seeing for her post-traumatic stress from 9/11, told me that he said, if she is not doing something similar again right now, she definitely will in the future. He said she absolutely will repeat this.
Well, it's sort of, I guess that explains a lot about that it's a compulsion, that it's not something that it sort of goes back to what I was saying before. You, in some level, you almost have to forgive her because it isn't something she can control. This is not a conscious choice that she gets to make about who she is. This is a driven, a psychologically driven affect. And
I would say so, yeah.
I mean, horror, again, not to, it isn't to to make it any less painful for the people who experienced her. It's, like any psychopath, going through the world, they're causing lots of damage as they go.
Yes.
Well, it is an incredible, incredible story, and I really appreciate you spending some time talking to me about it. I'm really glad you wrote the book, and I think I really want to compliment you on making it interesting, because as I said before, I think it's hard to tell a story where, in theory, we know what the end is. So
Yes.
there's a tension there for you writing the book, and I think as a reader, I appreciated the way you did it. I found it really compelling, and again, partially just because the subject is so incredible, but also I think you guys did a really good job of writing it and telling the story. So
Thank you.
I recommend this to readers, and want to thank you for talking to me about it.
Oh, it's been my great pleasure.
This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk, your host. I've been talking to Robin Gaby Fisher about the book, The Woman Who Wasn't There, that she co-authored with Angelo Guglielmo, which I want to make sure I include, and the book is out now. So thank you so much.